Why don't we read some more in chapter 2, self-consecration. We got to a break in the chapter. By the way, all these breaks were inserted by Sri Aurobindo when he revised this section of the book. He felt that they were distinct. They demarcated nicely one from the other. So, he was speaking about the significance of the self-offering, and that we don't see the divine as a mere extra cosmic reality, a transcendent beyond space and time to which we must somehow rise and get away from the world. Rather, he sees the divine as a half-veiled manifestation. It is an evolving discovery of the divine self that is being played out in cosmic terms and in every individual. The individual is an individual universe moving in a larger universe. So you are not a simple, minuscule being. You are enormously complex, richly sophisticated, but you possess a core truth, which is an eternal truth. And you are at one with all the cosmos, and wherever you turn your awakened gaze, eventually you will see that same self looking back at you. This is the promise of yoga, is that you will have this wonderful vision of oneness. And it's not a vision of unreality, it's not a hallucination. It is an insight into the nature of truth. So we will not renounce the world. We accept the world, and we will work out whatever perfection is possible, given its many difficulties. So, we begin then this section. There is another direction in which the ordinary practice of yoga arrives at a helpful but narrowing simplification, which is denied to the sadhaka of the integral aim. The practice of yoga brings us face to face with the extraordinary complexity of our own being. The stimulating, but also embarrassing multiplicity of our personality, the rich, endless confusion of nature. So you see here something recorded in his writing, which becomes the basis of many aspects of modern psychology. A great transpersonalist, you might say the founder of the transpersonal movement in the West, was Roberto Assagioli, a great Italian thinker and visionary. And one of the key insights that he offered was that while there is a deeper self, which is in connection with the higher aspect of reality, there is also, in the functioning play of our personalities on the surface, not a simple scheme in which there is one personality with numbers of moods, but many personalities, sub-personalities as he styled them, each jostling for supremacy. One rules the day now and another rules the day later. But there is a discourse, a marketplace of personalities, and they're in constant collision with each other. So part of what one does in arriving at the synthesis of psychology is to coordinate and harmonize these various elements. Then you can live a more productive life without the conflicts that so much people the lives of humanity. So Sri Aurobindo notes this right away. He continues, to the ordinary man who lives upon his own waking surface, ignorant of the self's depths and vastnesses behind the veil, his psychological existence is fairly simple. Now, remember back when we were reading The Life Divine, and we were in Book 2, Part 2, I think it was Chapter 19 that he gave perhaps the best description of an integral self and world knowledge which is possible to us, but it demands that we, in a sense, scrub ourselves clean of an original ignorance, an ignorance of the knowledge of the Absolute, that from which all things comes, all things come. And there's a sevenfold ignorance. We have to arrive at the replacement of ignorance with knowledge in all these seven categories. The first was the original, not knowing the Absolute. Another was the cosmic, not being aware of the many dimensions in the cosmos. We look at the world and we think it's the flat physical reality, but there is a layer cake of being represented in the cosmos, most of it unseen behind the surface. All you see is the skin when you look at the physical universe. You don't see the power behind, you don't see the mentation that guides, etc. So all these subliminal worlds are missing. So an original ignorance seconded by a cosmic ignorance. Then there's the egoistic ignorance, where we think that we're this shimmering surface being, this personality, but are unaware of the depths of our nature. We are not that ego. We are something altogether different. There is a temporal ignorance in which what we're aware of is this moment in time. We don't see all the past evolutionary history of self or cosmos, nor what we're preparing to do that will take fruit later in the future. So it furthers when we reach the level of a psychological ignorance, where we're unaware of the various strands of our being. If we plunge inside, we can see that there is an inner mind, an inner life force, even an inner physical being, which are ready for our exploration, with many powers which, if we tap them, we can express creatively in life, creatively in art, but powerfully in the ordinary ways that we do business and have commerce with each other. And then there's the constitutional ignorance, in which we don't know what constitutes us. We don't understand the context in which we move. And finally, the practical ignorance, where we have to deal with the world as it is and bring all of this to point. So a sevenfold ignorance speaking to us of many aspects of our being beyond the superficial. He continues now. A small but clamorous company of desires, some imperative intellectual and aesthetic cravings, some tastes, a few ruling or prominent ideas amid a great current of unconnected or ill-connected, and mostly trivial thoughts, a number of more or less imperative vital needs, alternations of physical health and disease, a scattered and in consequent succession of joys and griefs, frequent minor disturbances and vicissitudes, and rarer strong searchings and upheavals of mind or body, and through it all, nature, partly with the aid of his thought and will, partly without or in spite of it, arranging these things in some rough practical fashion, some tolerable disorderly order, this is the material of his existence. The average human being, even now, is in his inward existence as crude and undeveloped as was the bygone primitive man in his outward life. But as soon as we go deep within ourselves, and yoga means a plunge into all the multiple profundities of the soul, we find ourselves subjectively, as man in his growth has found himself objectively, surrounded by a whole complex world which we have to know and to conquer. So the person has to move outside the superficial realm of being and discover an interior world which he inhabits as well, and find that that interior world implies an interior cosmos, which is a larger context. So we can't afford to live anymore in an external being if we're going to practice yoga. The most disconcerting discovery is to find that every part of us, intellect, will, sense mind, nervous or desire self, the heart, the body, has each, as it were, its own complex individuality and natural formation, independent of the rest. It neither agrees with itself, nor with the others, nor with the representative ego, which is the shadow cast by some central and centralizing self on our superficial ignorance. So there is a central being, there is a psyche, which is core to us. It's the shadow thrown by that on the exterior nature, which we regard as ego and mistake to be our real self. That is impermanent, that is transient, that has no constitutional reality. It's temporary, it's a figuring. But these many, let's see, we find that we are composed not of one, but many personalities, and each has its own demands and differing nature. Our being is a roughly constituted chaos into which we have to introduce the principle of a divine order. Now that is yoga in the original sense. When it's used as a term in the Veda, it means harnessing, like you harness a wagon to a horse and pull it. That's what yoga means in the Rig Veda. When we get to the Katha Upanishad, it means taking the various elements of our psychological being, body, life, mind, the senses, and unifying them in a common effort to realize the divine self, the Atman, to know that which exceeds all measurement and all time. But this is the idea of yoga, to take the elements of the being and forge them into a working unity. That's the unity that yoga is seeking. Moreover, he writes, we find that inwardly too, no less than outwardly, we are not alone in the world. The sharp separateness of our ego was no more than a strong imposition and delusion. We do not exist in ourselves. We do not really live apart in an inner privacy or solitude. Our mind is a receiving, developing, and modifying machine into which there is being constantly passed from moment to moment a ceaseless foreign flux, a streaming mass of disparate materials from above, from below, from outside. So these are things that we become aware of in regard, to use Sri Aurobindo's terminology, as part of the circumconscient, that area that surrounds us. There's a circumference around us, which we can become aware of, as he did in 1908 in Baroda, when Lele said, sit, look, you'll see that thoughts come from outside. When they try to enter you, stop them. Sri Aurobindo, again, had never thought of it like that. But when he looked, he did indeed see that thoughts did not arise within the individual mind, but they came circling in from a universal mind. And he could, if he applied his will, refuse them entry. That led to a silenced mind, to the realization of Brahman in the cessation of involvement in the universe. Nirvanic Brahman was his state of awareness then. But he could still see, even in that state, all that was occurring in the inward universe and how it tries to circulate into us, coming to us in one ways, in some ways that are attractive to our nature, going to others with manners of presentation that are attractive to them. He goes back now to say, much more than half our thoughts and feelings are not our own in the sense that they take form out of ourselves. Of hardly anything can it be said that it is truly original to our nature. A large part comes to us from others or from the environment, whether as raw material or as manufactured imports. But still more largely, they come from universal nature here, or from other worlds and planes and their beings and powers and influences. For we are overtopped and environed by other planes of consciousness, mind planes, life planes, subtle matter planes, from which our life and action here are fed or fed on, pressed, dominated, made use of for the manifestation of their forms and forces. This is the commerce always going on in us. We think that we do this and do that, but we are being used often as instruments for expression. The universe is speaking through us, and all these forces above, below, and around have their innings in us. We can change that. We can become aware of the divine will and substitute our adhesion to that rather than to the call of nature, and that is what Sri Aurobindo will have us do in the practice of yoga. The difficulty of our separate salvation is immensely increased by this complexity and manifold openness and subjection to the in-streaming energies of the universe. Of all this, we have to take account, to deal with it, to know what is the secret stuff of our nature and its constituent and resultant motions, and to create in it all a divine center and a true harmony and luminous order. So we have to do this work from inside out, from the soul into the subliminal, all the way to the surface being. But if we don't get all the way to the soul, we can't affect a real transformation, even a beginning transformation of the nature. We'll continue to be subject to it unless we reach that depth. In the ordinary paths of yoga, the method used for dealing with these conflicting materials is direct and simple. One or another of the principal psychological forces in us is selected as our single means for attaining to the divine. The rest is quieted into inertia or left to starve in its smallness. The bhakta, seizing on the emotional forces of the being, the intense activities of the heart, abides concentrated in the love of God, gathered up as into a single one-pointed tongue of fire. He is indifferent to the activities of thought, throws behind him the importunities of the reason, cares nothing for the mind's thirst for knowledge. All the knowledge he needs is his faith and the inspirations that well up from a heart in communion with the divine. He has no use for any will to works that is not turned to the direct worship of the beloved or the service of the temple. the man of knowledge, self-confined by a deliberate choice to the force and activities of discriminative thought, finds release in the mind's hushed, inward-drawn endeavor. He concentrates on the idea of the self, succeeds by a subtle inner discernment in distinguishing its silent presence amid the veiling activities of nature. And through the perceptive idea, arrives at the concrete spiritual experience. He is indifferent to the play of the emotions, deaf to the hunger call of passion, closed to the activities of life. The more blessed he, the sooner they fall away from him and leave him free, still and mute, the eternal non-doer. The body is his stumbling block. The vital functions are his enemies. If their demands can be reduced to a minimum, that is his great good fortune. The endless difficulties that arise from the environing world are dismissed by erecting firmly against them a defense of outer physical and inner spiritual solitude. Safe behind a wall of inner silence, he remains impassive and untouched by the world and by others. To be alone with oneself or alone with the divine, to walk apart with God and his devotees, to entrench oneself in the single self-ward endeavor of the mind or Godward passion of the heart is the trend of these yogas. The problem is solved by the excision of all but the one central difficulty which pursues the one chosen motive force. Into the midst of the dividing calls of our nature, the principle of an exclusive concentration comes sovereignly to our rescue. So this call for renunciation, sannyasa, meditation, dhyana, or vichara, is the way of the man of knowledge, just as the exclusive adoration of the divine, communion with the divine, is the preferred path of the bhakta. So, but bhakti yoga and jnana yoga exclude the active life, leave the world untouched, and pull us away into a divorce from the world, which yet needs divine attention. Sri Aurobindo will push us past that. And he writes, but for the sadhaka of the integral yoga, this inner or this outer solitude can only be incidents or periods in his spiritual progress. By the time he revises this, of course, he's written hundreds and hundreds of letters on yoga, and there'll be occasion where we call attention to them in our study of the synthesis. But the requests that he would get from the sadhaks there in the ashram to have some chance to pull away and isolate themselves in profound contemplation, meditation for days, weeks, or months at a time, he would not give. He would give license to a few days of such settlement to spend too much time in isolation is antithetical to the aims of the yoga, because one ought to be able to live in silence, in the full awareness of the Atman, even as engaged in life, not rejecting life, but instead turning that light and that power around, instead of gathering it all inside and directing it energetically into the world. This is how we transform and change life. Absent that, why would the world change? So Sri Aurobindo writes, accepting life, he has to bear not only his own burden, but a great part of the world's burden too, along with it, as a continuation of his own sufficiently heavy load. Therefore, his yoga has much more of the nature of a battle than others. But this is not only an individual battle, it is a collective war waged over a considerable country. He has not only to conquer in himself the forces of egoistic falsehood and disorder, but to conquer them as representatives of the same adverse and inexhaustible forces in the world. So, we will have in the next chapter many occasions in which to speak about the teaching of the Gita, etc. But you can see here the nature of a battle. Kurukshetra is something that is always before us, where the forces of darkness are arrayed against the forces of light, and we have to discern correctly what is the right step for us to take and make certain that what we do is consecrated action. The chapter's title is self-consecration. So in an active life, how can we live dynamically and fruitfully and bring spiritual power into the government of human life? But as we take a step, it matters to the world if we fail or not. If we're smug and flip and say, well, I don't have to bother with that. After all, the world will take care of itself. No, everything that you do matters to the world. So if you remove an ignorance, if you bring light, it has an impact upon the globe dynamically, psychologically, and then that psychological fruit comes into manifestation in matter. Their representative character gives them a much more obstinate capacity of resistance, an almost endless right to recurrence. Often he finds that even after he has won persistently his own personal battle, he has still to win it over and over again in a seemingly interminable war, because his inner existence has already been so much enlarged that not only it contains his own being with its well-defined needs and experiences, but is in solidarity with the being of others, because in himself he contains the universe. This is true not only of the rare seeker of the integral yoga, who's pushing into those farther frontiers, but it is a continuing experience of those who have gained enlightenment across the world in every tradition. This is a common refrain. This is what it feels like. And so the work that you do reverberates through the world. Nor is the seeker of the integral fulfillment permitted to solve too arbitrarily even the conflict of his own inner members. He has to harmonize deliberate knowledge with unquestioning faith. He must conciliate the gentle soul of love with the formidable need of power. The passivity of the soul that lives content in transcendent calm has to be fused with the activity of the divine helper and the divine warrior. So these must be brought together. Conciliate means to gain or win over, to reconcile, or to make friends. So to conciliate the gentle soul of love with the formidable need of power. These are allies and aspects of a central conscious power of chit shakti. Chit is not absent love, and it is instinct with power. We must be both the divine helper and the divine warrior at the same time that we have settled into the awareness of the transcendence of that reality which is beyond time and space. To him, as to all seekers of the Spirit, there are offered for solution the oppositions of the reason, the clinging hold of the senses, the perturbations of the heart, the ambush of the desires, the clog of the physical body. But he has to deal in another fashion with their mutual and internal conflict and their hindrance to his aim. For he must arrive at an infinitely more difficult perfection in the handling of all this rebel matter. Accepting them as instruments for the divine realization and manifestation, he has to convert their jangling discords, to enlighten their thick darknesses, to transfigure them separately and altogether, harmonizing them in themselves and with each other, integrally, omitting no grain or strand or vibration, leaving no iota of imperfection anywhere. An exclusive concentration, or even a succession of concentrations of that kind, can be, in his complex work, only a temporary convenience. It has to be abandoned as soon as its utility is over. An all-inclusive concentration is the difficult achievement towards which he must labor. So you see that each area is its own tableau. Each part of the nature presents a problem or a conflict or an unresolved issue. And in each, there must be a perfection achieved with the soul's inlook, fusing its power, drawing transcendence from above when necessary to achieve it. But then, moving beyond the isolated perfection to a larger integrated harmony. Fundamentally, this last sentence notes that it is possible, as he says in his letters on yoga, to concentrate on the one who is everywhere. This is what that Sanskrit chant that Shantipat calls us to when we commence our meetings. Purnam Madaha, Purnam Idam. Because that is full. This is full. The full is taken out of the full. Take out the full from the full remains. Wherever you place your gaze, you see the same reality. There is only one reality. It is unmanifest, not disclosed, or it is manifest, as Sri Aurobindo says about this cosmos that we inhabit. It's a half-veiled manifestation of the divine. We partly see, we partly do not see its greater nature. Our purpose is through self-perfectioning to arrive at a greatening of the cosmic order, to introduce into the world sublimities that can transform it. Those sublimities live within us. We must find them, a secret treasure, and then share. So that's a good place to end for the evening. So in Savitri, there's a passage in Book 2, the Book of the Traveler of the Worlds, in the first canto, The World Stair. It begins in this book on page 98. This was the single stair to being's goal. A summary of the stages of the spirit. Its copy of the cosmic hierarchies, refashioned in our secret air of self, a subtle pattern of the universe. It is within, below, without, above. Acting upon this visible nature's scheme, it wakens our earth matter's heavy doze to think and feel and to react to joy. It models in us our diviner parts, lifts mortal mind into a greater air, makes yearn this life of flesh to intangible aims, links the body's death with immortality's call. Out of the swoon of the inconscience, it labors towards a superconscient light. If earth were all, and this were not in her, thought could not be, nor life delight's response. Only material forms could then be her guests, driven by an inanimate world force. Earth, by this golden superfluity, bore thinking man, and more than man shall bear. This higher scheme of being is our cause, and holds the key to our ascending fate. It calls out of our dense mortality the conscious spirit nursed in matter's house. The living symbol of these conscious planes, its influences and godheads of the unseen, its unthought logic of reality's acts, arisen from the unspoken truth in things, have fixed our inner life's slow-scaled degrees. Its steps are paces of the soul's return from the deep adventure of material birth, a ladder of delivering ascent and rungs that nature climbs to deity. Once, in the vigil of a deathless gaze, these grades had marked her giant downward plunge, the wide and prone leap of a godhead's fall. Our life is a holocaust of the supreme. The great world mother, by her sacrifice, has made her soul the body of our state. Accepting sorrow and unconsciousness, divinity's lapse from its own splendors wove the many-patterned ground of all we are. An idol of self is our mortality. Our earth is a fragment and a residue. Her power is packed with the stuff of greater worlds and steeped in their color lusters dimmed by her drowse. An atavism of higher births is hers. Her sleep is stirred by their buried memories, recalling the lost spheres from which they fell. Unsatisfied forces in her bosom move. They are partners of her greater growing fate and her return to immortality. They consent to share her doom of birth and death. They kindle partial gleams of the all and drive her blind, laborious spirit to compose a meager image of the mighty whole. The calm and luminous intimacy within approves her work and guides the unseeing power. his vast design accepts a puny start. An attempt, a drawing half done, is the world's life. Its lines doubt their concealed significance. Its curves join not their high intended close. Yet some first image of greatness trembles there, and when the ambiguous crowded parts have met the many-toned unity to which they moved, the artist's joy shall laugh at reason's rules. The divine intention suddenly shall be seen. The end vindicate intuition's sure technique. A graph shall be of many meeting worlds, a cube and union crystal of the gods. A mind shall think behind nature's mindless mask. A conscious vast fill the old dumb brute space. This faint and fluid sketch of soul called man shall stand out on the background of long time, a glowing epitome of eternity. A little point reveal the infinitudes. A mystery's process is the universe. Thank you for your kind attention. Namaste, Jai Ma.